by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch, row by row, someone blessed these seeds I sowed. Someone warmed them from below till the rains come tumbling down.
Welcome to the Bannock Gardener, where every week we address some issue about organic and sustainable gardening or some larger ecological or political issue relating to those things. This week is on the ground how-tos about lawn reformation, how to remake your lawn, redo your yard so that it is more eco-friendly and even more friendly to you as a gardener. I'm Kate Gardner. Be sure to check out the parallel post on the blog at themanicgardener.com. Now, last week's show may well have scared the bejesus out of you with all of its high-tech modeling about the extent of lawns in the United States and all those statistics about how much water and pesticide and herbicides we put on our lawns and where those end up. This week, we hope to strike a more hopeful note. And to help me do so, I have with me Evelyn Haddon. She is the author of this year's book, Beautiful No-Mow Yards, 50 Amazing Lawn Alternatives. She's also written two other books. She's a national speaker as well. She founded Less Lawn and is a founding member of the Lawn Reform Coalition, along with such people, Tom Christopher, Neil Dibble, and Paul Tukey. You can find Less Lawn at LessLawn.com, the Lawn Reform Coalition at LawnReform.org, and Evelyn herself at EvelynHaydon.com. Now, we're going to look in detail at some solutions and alternatives to the conventional lawn. And often, time and money are always obstacles, of course, but often people will say something like, well, I've got kids, I have to have a lawn, or, but I have all these trees, or, what am I going to do with that hill over there? And all of these things get addressed in Evelyn's book, and she's going to talk about each of these today as well. We're going to start with the basics, but I do promise we will get around to those particular design issues and spend a little bit of time as well on the larger problems you face when you start to try to redesign a lawn. Welcome, Evelyn.
Well, thank you, Kate. I'm happy to be speaking with you.
It's mutual. So could you start, actually, by giving us some sense of what the possibilities here are when somebody redoes their lawn?
I go through 11 different categories of possibilities in the beginning part of Beautiful No Mow Yards.
We'll hit on those a little later, but for the moment, can you just give us a picture of something, maybe a before and after,
for instance? I have a friend's Karen and Tom, and they have a backyard that's really steeply sloped in an urban area, and I was at their house for dinner right after they had gotten it renovated. They had a landscaper come in and put in terraces, so they had a couple of flat places where they could sit outside, and then they had all these boulders to help retain what were really quite steep areas all around the patios. And as we sat there having dinner, you know, I could see that the mulch and the soil that they had put on those slopes had already kind of washed down onto the patios. And I said, so what are you going to plant? They didn't know, because they said, well, we kind of, you know, it's expensive to put in all this other stuff, and so whatever we do, it'll have to be inexpensive. So I helped them come up with a plan, and we used prairie plants. And so now they have a great slope full of deep-rooted flowers and grasses and even low ground covers that give them color and interest and a changing sort of dinner show from spring through fall.
So there's dinner music, and now there are dinner gardens.
And they have their own music, you know, there are crickets and little chirping birds and that sort of thing. A prairie is a very lively place.
Yeah, and even a small yard can actually bring in a lot of wildlife that you won't see even next door.
It
in
sure
a conventional
can.
Yard. Yeah. And you've got actually two great photographs, at least two, of this yard in your book that show the bare ground.
Yeah. I just happened to snap a picture of that, and I was glad I did.
Yeah. Came in handy later because I must say the contrasting picture with all of those plants growing is pretty extraordinary. And you say you get color throughout the seasons there?
That's right. We started, we planned it so that something would be blooming all the growing season long. You know, here in Minnesota now you don't have really anything in the winter except to have some sort of structures that will act as snow sculptures. But for the rest of the time when there's not snow, we wanted things to be blooming or showing color. The thing about prairies that's so great is that they have a different season of show than other traditional gardens because they have a lot of fall interest. Those grasses change color and create a really great display, as you can see. I think there's a shot in the book of
there is
loose stem grasses.
And one of the things that I find really important and interesting here is and you stress this several different times, that when we usually think about color in a garden, a lot of us still think about flowers. And you point out that foliage and grasses and grass heads, seeds, can also provide really important color interest in a garden.
And don't forget shrubs. Those are my favorites, and they
provide
a lot of color.
Yeah.
Well,
with that in mind, that we can really have something quite lovely, as well as ecologically appropriate, let's go on to the really big question that just about everybody, you know, even thinking about doing this comes up against, which is, yeah, but how do I start? I've got all this grass. I've got this lawn. How do I deal with it? It's all very well to talk about how lovely it can be after it's gone, but there it is. So can we start with that bottom rung? How do you get rid of a lawn?
Sure. And we just won't mince words. We're killing it. How do we kill the lawn? So let's start with if you are a kind of person who needs quick results and you want to be able to plant pretty soon, then you might dig up your turf. And that's a lot of work, and it also takes up some of your topsoil, so you might have to replenish some soil later on. But it gets rid of almost all the weeds, and you can then plant right away and have a pretty weed-free garden.
You said that it's actually possible to roll up turf. I mean, we've all seen people rolling it out when somebody puts in grass. But can you actually roll up turf?
Oh, yeah. And in fact, especially if you have the kind of turf that's been really well watered and that sort of thing, it probably has quite shallow roots. I've done it before. You just take a straight edge shovel and you make a line, and then you make a line parallel to it, maybe a foot apart, and then you dig up one end of it and start rolling, and you'll be surprised. You may have dandelions that sort of stick their roots in and are harder to pull up with the rest of the lawn. They're almost like little nails in a piece of cloth or something.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have very many of those tap-rooted weeds, you can just roll the turf right up. And then you can either set it out on the curb and say free and someone will take it away, or you can use it to build a boom elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Or compost it.
Yep. It makes great soil.
Yep. Okay, so you could just stack the stuff with the grass side down and cover it with a tarp so it doesn't start growing again?
You can do all sorts of things. Yes, you can cover it with a tarp and let it decay. That's a good idea. You can also smother it, as we'll talk about later. You can actually smother over the top of your turf that you've moved and stacked somewhere. And that works really well, too.
Well, what do you mean about smothering it? Because you started by saying, well, this was the way to go if you wanted quick results. Kill it by removing the turf. What are these other ways?
Okay, well, so let's go to the longest way then, and that's smothering. And that's also my favorite way.
Why is that?
It's really the most ecologically beneficial, and it's the least amount of work. So for two reasons, it's my favorite.
Good reasons.
The first, the ecologically beneficial part. What happens when you smother is you spread layers of newspapers or cardboard, and then you top those with a layer of mulch, and you put them just right on top of the lawn. You might mow the lawn real short first, but you don't have to remove any lawn or anything. You're just adding layers over the top of it. And that has to be left down for months, sometimes a year, depending on what the weather is like, what your climate is like, when you do it, what is growing in your lawn and how soon it can be killed, how much sun, all those factors. So you just sort of have to every now and then pick up a corner and see if it's dead yet. But the thing is that the lawn decays and turns into really nice topsoil, and so does the layer of newspapers or cardboard. It's decomposed, too, by all those all that soil life that comes in, and the soil life is attracted to that decaying lawn. So you're kind of attracting all that soil life to your area by smothering your lawn, and then it will help aerate your soil, and it will process all this stuff and turn it into nutrients, so it's creating this really good bed for your plants to grow in later.
Yeah, and if you put down a thick enough layer of, you know, a mulch that contains compost or soil, for instance, you can even plant in it right away.
Yeah, you can plant in it right away. You can just, you can plant through your layer of cardboard or newspapers by just making an X and then pulling back the corners and then digging a hole. And you might get a few weeds that creep in, you know, into that hole and come out the hole with your regular plant, but mostly you'll still be in pretty good shape.
I've done that quite successfully, and I managed the creepy weeds up those little holes by digging out my planting holes ahead of time and weeding very, very thoroughly in those few areas so that I knew where I was going to be planting, and I had almost no weeds come up. So
that's a great idea, digging your holes first, and then you can really take the cardboard or newspapers and actually go over the edges of the holes right into them.
Yes, I did cover everything, but I knew where I was going to plant ahead of time, and this was a place with some really horrible weeds. I think it was creeping bellflower, so they're very, very deep tap roots. It was a large area. I there was no way I wanted to dig all of it out.
No, that's
but
thing.
By
it's too hard.
I just dug in a few little areas and covered it with newspaper mulch. Put a few plants in, and within I think 2 to 3 years, those other things were dead. But in the meantime, it still looked like a garden bed, sparsely planted, but something.
Yeah, it's nice to have something growing in there just for fun. And, one easy idea, too, if you don't want to have all that bare mulch hanging around, is to plant something like pumpkins, you know, the first year, and just you make those little tiny holes.
Cover the surface.
Yeah, but then you get a lot of foliage and even fruit, so it's more interesting than just plain old mulch.
Of course. That's a great idea. Well, what other? Okay, so you can dig up the topsoil. You can, the lawn. You can smother it. What else?
So another quick one that's gonna not give you a weed-free bed, but it's gonna give you the ability to plant right away is tilling. That's where you get a rototiller or something, or even manually, you just dig up all of the lawn, and maybe you pull out the clumps, and then the rest of it is just sort of left there. That is pretty quick and easy if you rent a rototiller or something. It's maybe good if you need to aerate the soil, but it really destroys a lot of soil life and soil structure if you have existing soil life and soil structure. And another thing that it does is it could possibly spread some plants. Even if you chop up their roots into tiny little pieces, they end up a new plant growing from each little piece. So you
like the
careful.
Creeping carragana.
Yeah.
The creeping bellflower. Yeah, and bindweed will do that. What are some others that you want to be careful of?
Thistles will do that. Thistles. And there is a whole list of plants that will do that. So it's not an ideal way to do it, but it can be fairly cheap and quick. And so it might be worth it to you, say, to maybe till and then plant your things right away, and then maybe mulch will heavily around them or something.
And it might be worth, would that be something you would want to consider, for instance, if you had a seriously compacted area?
Right. It really aerates the soil and kind of you start over.
One-time tillage.
Yeah. You wouldn't want to till every year, but one time maybe it would be worthwhile to improve the structure of the soil and give your plants a chance.
What about using black plastic to smother instead of all this newspaper and mulch?
Yeah. I've had really good luck with that. Now that I've moved from my urban lot, where smothering worked great, I'm in an old field now, and I have some serious plants like reed canary grass that don't die if you smother them. I've tried huge bound up layers and layers of cardboard boxes, right on top, and still somehow.
It comes through
after, a year and a half of thinking, well, maybe it's dead. It'll start poking its little head up. So what I've had really good luck with is this, what I call solarizing.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that it's so effective is it comes at them in several different ways. So you get some really thick black plastic, and I find mine at home store or a farm store. It comes in big rolls. It's about 10 feet wide and maybe 50 feet long when you unroll it. So you can do a nice size chunk of land, and you just flatten it down real well. So you mow real short and then flatten this plastic against the ground. So it cuts off the sunlight because it's black.
So you need to weight it down
with rocks or bricks or mulch or whatever. I use a light layer of mulch just so that it looks better. But I've seen it just held down by rocks at the edges too. But it eliminates the sunlight, so your plants under there aren't getting any sunlight. It doesn't let any water through, so they aren't getting any water. So that's two ways. And then the third way is it also heats up under there, and it can get so hot that it can sterilize that top layer of soil. It'll actually kill seeds that are right in that top layer of soil before they get a chance to germinate. So if you have a huge seed bed full of weeds, you had a lot of annual weeds that went to seed for years and just piled up in the soil, it's a good option for kind of clearing that stuff away and giving yourself a fighting chance to have a more weed-free planting.
Of course, it's not as kind to the creatures in the soil.
It is not.
So it's not the first choice.
No, it is not. It eliminates all the water, that they would need as well, and that heat is really hard on them. It dries everything out. So it's not as ecologically sound as smothering, but it does the same thing that smothering does in that it converts your lawn to topsoil, and that's good later on when you pull back that plastic and everything is dead. Then you can plant right in that nice fresh dead layer of lawn, and it gives your plants a good start too once those soil creatures start coming back.
Well, what about just spraying this stuff? Just get out the herbicide. Which, of course, we don't advocate because this is an organic show, but...
Yeah, I don't advocate it either. I'm real cautious when it comes to using chemicals in the house and the yard, just because of the growing body of research that's pointing to possible or proven harmful effects. Effects on ourselves, effects on our children, our pets, on you know, species that we didn't mean to kill, that we don't want to kill necessarily, but that are also targeted by these, you know, non-specific herbicides and insecticides. So I say, well, as far as the chemicals go, I guess, if you are at the point where you are maintaining your yard by using a lot of chemicals and you would maybe just want to dose it once with something and then kill it off and then turn it into an organic garden, well, I can see, you know, where that would be, in the long run, a good move and a positive change.
In a sense, if the only way that you can face doing this, entering into this transition, would be by starting with herbicide, then do it that way.
Yeah,
but if you can possibly wrap your mind, you know, your wallet or your body around the smothering, do that.
Yeah, and I appreciate that there are things that it's just really hard to kill. You know, I've talked to endless number of gardeners with buckthorn and all sorts of things that they are battling, and they just are at their wit's end. And so I understand why people may need to turn to chemicals, just because that might be their only option that they can see. But I just, I really do like to focus on all these other options, you know, just because that those might work.
Yeah.
And they're healthier.
Exactly. I've used newspaper, and I actually wouldn't advocate that for large areas unless you've got a team and they're well coordinated, because they can be hard to handle. But there's also landscape paper, which you can roll out and is very quick to put down.
Now, I haven't tried that, but I have a friend who used appliance boxes. She went to an appliance store and got a bunch of refrigerator boxes.
Beautiful.
Yeah, which are huge, and you just overlap them a little bit, and they're real thick. So they worked very well.
I bet they did. Okay, so we now have a dead lawn.
That's right.
Great. What's our next step?
Well, you can plant your plants in the dead lawn. You can sow seed. You can sow seed by... you'd most likely want to add a light layer of soil and then put your seed in that, just to give it a nice head start.
Now, if I've done the smothering and I've used a nice mulch, would I need to add soil as well?
If you've smothered and you've got a mulch, there are seeds that will grow in that and seeds that will have a hard time with that. You know, a lot of seeds like really fine-grained soil so that they can actually stay moist, and they don't like much shade, and so your mulch pieces might be too large for them. So if you've used a mulch and you want to sow seed, I might suggest moving it aside and putting down a little dirt and just sowing your seed in a little bare patch.
Or else just cover it with enough soil so that what you're looking at is soil instead of chips of bark.
Right, right. Yeah, and that's not ideal, because you want the roots to be able to get down into the actual ground, so you don't want them to try and work their way through a big layer of wood chips.
So a light layer of soil means several inches, 6 inches? Even?
Oh, no.
Because that sounds heavy.
No, just 2 inches would probably be enough. Yeah, it depends on your plants. You know, a lot of these things do depend on so many things.
Yeah, that's what makes it more interesting and more difficult. Well, very quickly, let's talk then about maintaining this once you have it planted, and then we'll go backwards again and talk in more detail about the design pieces so that you would be able to begin to think about what you would be planting in this now, where the grass used to be, the X lawn. But once I have things planted, what can I expect to have to do to maintain a newly planted X lawn?
Oh, again, it varies widely depending on what you have planted, but you'll probably need to water initially so that things get off to a good start. It's always better if they can sort of skip their juvenile stage and get through it quickly. Then they end up being a lot more self-sustaining later on in their lives.
Well, do I have to water even if I've put in all native plants?
If you have used seed and you just want to wait for things to germinate on sort of their natural schedule based on whatever rainfall you get, then you wouldn't need to water. If you've put in little seedlings that are native, yes, you need to water them just to get them established. Now, here in my climate, which gets about 36 inches of rain a year, unlike yours, I know.
And you're in Minnesota.
I'm in Minnesota. So I usually advise people, well, put in your seedlings and water them maybe every day for the first few days, and then space it out to every couple of days for the next week, and then every week for the next month, and then maybe you won't need to anymore. But it depends on whether you have sandy soil, which they might need a lot more water to get established in, or clay soil, which you wouldn't want to water them a lot because they might drown. I'm making it sound complicated, but really, you know, you get the hang of these things by just observing. So you water your plants, and then before you water them again, you just stick your finger in the soil and see if it's wet. And if it's wet, they don't need water. And if it's dry, then yeah, they need water. If it's really dry, maybe you should have watered yesterday, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a matter of kind of experiencing your own yard and really learning what works in that place.
Yeah, I think it's useful to know, though, that even natives need to be watered, because a lot of people think it's natives, they don't need water. Well, that's in their native environment where they've germinated in place.
Right.
Even young plants then can survive. But if you've got something that's potted, usually its roots are restricted. It might not be in native soil. You're not putting it in native soil. It takes a while to get established, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and so, you do damage the roots a little bit and set it back just by moving it from its pot to the ground. So, you need.
So they need to be pampered a little for a while.
Yeah, but I wouldn't fertilize them or anything like that. I mean, I don't think you need to do anything other than just water them.
That's a helpful tip. Thank you. Okay, let's talk about actual design. And the first part of your book, the bulk of it really, is these 11 design possibilities that you mentioned right at the beginning. And these are sort of the basis for the necessary imaginative work that somebody needs to do in order to be able to imagine a new and different yard. So do you want to just run through these for us?
Sure, and that's a really good way to put it, the necessary imaginative work, because it is a lot of work. It's thinking, just kind of dreaming, you know, consciously dreaming about your yard and what it could be. And that is really helpful to help to get yourself to the point where you can see it well enough in your mind to be able to try and do it on the ground. But I do have all different kinds of options. So for somebody who wants low maintenance, you know, maybe you'd start with a living carpet, which is kind of gives you a low open feel like a lawn, but it's maybe doesn't need mowing, and maybe it flowers during part of the year, has different foliage colors or something like that. So it has a little bit more of variety than a lawn would, but same feel, kind of low open feel.
And may need lots less water, too.
Oh, sure. If you choose the plants that are well adapted to your environment, they're often going to need less water than a lawn, because very few parts of the country deliver enough water at the right time of year to support a lawn.
Yeah, exactly. They're really based on a British world where there's lots and lots and lots of rain.
Yeah. And not a lot of really hot sun.
Exactly.
So you have living carpets, and then another option would be if you happen to have sun to do something like a meadow or a prairie. We've heard quite a bit about those options recently. We've had several good books come out describing how to do those. And those are basically mixes of grasses and flowers that look a little more natural and might be taller, so something that you would walk through on a path rather than walking on top of like you would a living carpet. And then if you happen to have shade, you know, I have a section on shade gardens as well. So
that's really helpful because, again, this is one of the things that people sort of beat their heads against the wall about. Well, you know, I don't get any sun, so I can't grow anything.
And yet I find that the things that you feel like are the biggest challenges can end up being a really great opportunity. You know, a shade garden gives you a chance to make a place that's really peaceful and contemplative. You just can't get that same mood in a sunny spot. You know, it's going to give you a very different mood. Even if it's nice and serene, it's still not going to be the same sheltering environment as a woodland-type garden.
Or a little woodland glade. It could be tiny, but
it can still be lovely.
Yeah, and you have so many useful suggestions here about, you mentioned that a lot of shade plants have very large leaves, which have evolved to gather more of the filtered light.
That's right.
And that others have very, you know, feathery leaves like ferns, and so you can do a lot with different textures. You say something about colors also, how can you have color contrast in the shade where most blooming flowers don't grow?
Yeah, and foliage really does shine in the shade. I mean, that's where you just notice the subtle differences more, maybe because there aren't those bright colors to distract you. And so if something has a little bit of variegation or if it has a ruffly texture or a puckered texture or a hairy texture, you notice more, and those are real appealing contrasts that you can add.
So there's a lot to be done there. And then you've got rain gardens.
Yes, rain gardens are real popular where I live in Minneapolis-St. Paul area. A lot of gardeners know about them, and they're really finding out how useful they are, and they don't even have to be very big to be useful at addressing runoff. And they are a great opportunity to plant a whole different set of plants. You know, you're creating this little microclimate when you create a rain garden, and it's
essentially a place where you're collecting rainwater and in order to keep it from just flowing off the property into the street. Or
yes, and you're not just collecting it, you're helping it filter into the ground. So it doesn't, collect like a pond or a bowl full of water. It really acts to catch the water and then spread it out and soak it up into the ground quickly so that you don't have standing water. So that's a big thing to emphasize with rain gardens.
You might do it at the shore of, or before the shore of a stream, so that water rushing down the slope of your lawn might have gone straight into a stream in the past. Now you have a rain garden, which filters it.
Yeah, so you have a nice buffer, a shoreline buffer maybe of plants, and those do the same thing as rain garden plants do. They filter the water, the pollutants out of the water before it reaches that stream.
Okay. Then we've got patios.
And ponds are two kind of overlooked substitutes for lawn that I think are really useful. Patios are great for places that we want to use heavily, where we maybe have furniture. It's hard to move and mow under. We might be able to use them in more seasons than we do a lawn. And ponds are nice because they bring in light and they bring in a lot of reflected movement, movement of the clouds. They bring in water animals like dragonflies and frogs. So they create a really great environment, and they can be interactive too. If you make them swimmable, you can have beaches, you know, you can have bridges. So all sorts of interesting features there.
Then you've got xeric gardens. Now, could you explain this first?
Those are gardens that that applies for a part of the country that maybe has say less than 20 inches of rain a year, real arid areas where you don't get as much water. It just doesn't work to put in those same kinds of plants that you might put in if you got, you know, 40 to 60 inches of water like some of the East Coast does. So there's a really different palette of plants, but still quite interesting and varied, and you can have a lush garden, but you just choose the plants that are adapted to dry conditions, and then you have a lush garden with less work, less water.
And then you've got your edible gardens, you've got stroll gardens, and finally smarter lawns, and that's... What does that mean? I think it's interesting. It's the last thing.
Smarter lawns are, there's sort of several different categories in there. One of them is using a different type of plant rather than, you know, the Kentucky bluegrass or the zoysia grass or whatever it is that you have in your lawn. Taking a grass or a grass-like plant that's adapted, like a sedge, it looks like a grass to us, but it's not technically a grass. But taking something that looks like grass and using that as a lawn. A lot of things, a lot of these plants are mowable. A lot of them grow slower than some of the typical lawn grasses, and so you wouldn't have to mow them as often. So they're often called no-mow lawns. Now, a lot of them don't want extra water or fertility, so it's better if you put them in a place that you haven't amended the soil and you aren't going to irrigate, which is great if you want less work.
So even if there is some area where you want the grass look, mm-hmm. there are ways to do even this that are more ecologically friendly.
That's right, and so that's what I mean by smarter lawns. Smarter for the environment, and it's also smarter because you don't work as hard to take care of them.
I love that payoff. Great.
And one category I want to mention too of a smarter lawn is a freedom lawn, and this is an old-fashioned concept that I think it's really important to talk about again. Because it used to be that our classy lawn mixes all had white clover in them because people recognized that it was a good nitrogen fixer and it has maybe a longer period of green than a lawn would have in a lot of climates. And what happened was when broadleaf weed killers were developed, oh no, they killed clover. And so we were the recipients of this big marketing scheme to tell us that all broadleaf plants, including clover, are bad. But, you know, who is telling us that? It's the people who are selling us things to kill the broadleaf plants. So I feel like we should stop and think about that for a minute.
Indeed.
And
indeed.
Perhaps incorporate some plants that have different kinds of leaves.
I have a question about this.
Yes.
The clover in my yard grows as a dense mat. Sends out, I don't know, even know if they're above ground, rhizomes, and just makes a solid mat and kills the grass. But the white clover that used to be in grass seed did not grow in this fashion. Am I right?
I think that white clover usually does spread by rhizomes. I think it will take over if it is better adapted than the grass is. So I believe you have probably the same clover that was used in lawn mixes, and it's just that your grass is not as well adapted to that place as your clover is. Could be that you have a nice drier spot there than the grass can handle, and the clover.
But the clover is happy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One other advantage of clover, of course, that you may have mentioned this already, but it stays green all summer.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't go through that period in the middle of the summer where it turns brown. And another nice advantage if you have kids is they get to look for four-leaf clovers.
Of course.
Which I think is a very important part of childhood.
Exactly, yes. Except that, you know, my sisters were so much better at it than I was that I was never sold on it as an activity.
Well, to each his own, I suppose.
I guess so. Well, those are the various things one has to work with, the possibilities. But then there's the lawn you're looking at. when you, you know, walk out your back door or your front door, and with all of its, you know, various idiosyncrasies. How do you deal, for instance, with trees? You talk about creating tree islands.
Yeah.
What are these exactly?
It's a really good place to start if you're thinking about shrinking your lawn in an area and you want to do something that's really going to boost the health of your garden and lower your maintenance both at the same time. I'm big on these double payoffs, these win-win situations, and this is one of them. If you have a tree growing in a lawn, chances are neither of those plants is happy with that arrangement. The tree wants different things than the lawn does. You know, the tree is dropping its leaves periodically, and it wants to create this nice layer of leaves that then attracts soil life, and the soil life decomposes those leaves and turns them into food for the tree. So there's this big cycle that the tree could be part of that will make it healthier and more self-sustaining. And what do we do with a lawn? We put the lawn right under there. We mow it really short so it maybe dries out. The lawn competes with the tree for moisture. The tree competes with the lawn for sun. And we're compacting the soil as we're walking around and mowing. It just isn't a good fit. So if you can take an island of plants and just put them around your lawn tree, instead give it companions that are healthier and more useful. That's a really great place to get a win-win.
One of my favorite photographs in your book actually is of some specialized kind of geranium, and of course I can't remember what it is, in a Minnesota arboretum.
Yeah, the wild geranium.
It's
a hillside full of wild geranium, and I forget the exact Latin name, but it's a Bigfoot, big root geranium or something like that. And it just flowers most of the year, and then it, big root geranium, yeah, Geranium macrorhizum Inglerson variety. It's been growing under those mature oaks and maples at the arboretum for about 25 years with really very little care. It
and
flowers
it's got beautiful lilac purplish blooms.
Yeah, and then the fall color is spectacular, I think. It's got reds and oranges and kind of a pinkish tone to it, and it happens right when the trees' leaves are all changing color above, so you've got this gorgeous carpet of color as well.
It's really is beautiful in both of the photographs. And I mean, the autumn one, it looks like a drift of New England, you know, maple leaves of mixed colors, yellows and reds,
mm-hmm.
drifted across the lawn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it gives you months and months of show. It needs no care. And it really suppresses weeds quite well. It's pretty thick, and, you know, it's just covering the slope under these trees.
So perfect, certainly, for the northern areas. So tree islands, what if I've got a bunch of trees?
Yeah, sometimes you think about that and you think, well, I don't want to make myself an obstacle course when I'm mowing, you know, having an island here, an island there that I have to go around. So if you can set it up so that you have larger islands, sometimes that's nicer. And a grove of trees is a big feature. It's on a scale that really set off a house nicely. And then you get an opportunity to kind of reduce the amount of edge you're creating. Edges are always kind of high maintenance areas because you got two different types of thing, one on either side of the edge. So if you can make a grove, you know, and an island that encompasses several trees, you can be better off that way as far as maintenance goes, and even make your feature more spectacular. You could even make a large enough that you can put a path. There's one picture in the book of a grove of old spruces, and there's a path running through the island of spruces, and it's gives the garden another experience. You know, you can walk through this shady grove of trees in addition to being outside it on the sunnier lawn, you know, so then you have two different types of experiences.
I think that you also mention somewhere that somebody's path became a favorite of visiting children. And I promised that we would talk about the issue of children. And I found that interesting because we tend to think children need wide open spaces to play in. And this idea that, yes, but they also love to explore a winding path, of course, is just reminds me of how true that is, how much I loved to do it myself, and gets me outside of that particular box of children, lawn, that, you know, yeah. is usually so confining.
Yeah, well, and research is really helping us out here, because the more research builds up, the more it shows that kids for healthy brains and bodies, kids need way more than that. You know, they do like to run, and that's what you can do in a wide open space, but they also really need to move their bodies in different ways to develop coordination and to develop emotional capacities, like the, you know, the peekaboo game is really an important developmental step. Well, you can have peekaboo type experiences in your yard too, and that really helps build self-confidence. You know, you might have one of those tree islands and the kids could run around and around and they would see you, and then you would disappear from view, and they would see you and you would disappear from view, and that really develops this sense of safety and this ability to be apart, you know, for periods
or
of time.
Or shrubbery that you duck behind and then mm-hmm. jump out from.
And shrubs are huge for kids. I mean, that was one of my biggest memories of being a kid, hiding in shrubs, you know, and I think almost every kid has felt this urge to just go under the shrubs and among the shrubs and be in those little cave-like places that seem meant for kids.
The secret garden.
Yeah. That's really an important thing that kids need, too, is to sort of make their own little secret places or find their own little hidden dens. And those places become really important when they need comfort or when they want to feel safe or dream outside.
You can't do that in a wide open lawn. You need a stretch. It can be a 3-foot wide stretch of shrubs.
Yeah.
But something where you can creep in and make your own little space.
Yeah, and then you get in inside the plant and you're up close to it, and then you have all those textures. You have the textures of the different trunks. You see the undersides of the leaves. You might see some interesting bugs. You know, whatever is growing under the shrub might be interesting too. Maybe there's a patch of violets or something. So lots of different sensory experiences there, and that is the key.
It's much more intimate, yeah. Well, you also talk about climbing.
Yeah.
Can you say a bit about that?
That appealed to you, didn't it? The climbing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, climbing is huge for kids, and, you know, so that's why now instead of just a lawn, a lot of people say, well, I need a playset too. So I need a lawn with a playset. But
on it.
Climbing, you can climb other things. You don't have to go buy a playset. You can find ways to have your kids climb trees. You can stack some boulders that they could climb. It's good for them to experience different textures and different materials underfoot and kind of get, you know, used to balancing and that sort of thing in a safer way. And you can really set up things that are pretty low care, you know, bring in an old log. they have nature centers now that have stumps of different heights, and the kids can jump from one to the other, and it's found to be a really important type of play.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I lived in Japan, there were a number of such play areas or structures with vastly different things, and one of them was a something you run from station to station through the woods, and one would be, you know, as you said, a series of stumps, and one would be a rope structure that you climbed. A whole variety of different things, and kids loved them.
Oh, it sounds so fun, doesn't it? I think adults would love it too.
Oh, we did. You also talk about, again, you sort of this double service business, using a trellis or other structure that you need in your garden and building it strong enough for kids to climb.
Sure, sure. There's no end to the ways that you can allow kids to experience parts of your garden, and you can just pay attention to safety and make sure that, you know, these structures are stable enough. But then think of the adventures that the kids could have, and think of the ways that they can be creative. You know, when they have something like a tree that they're climbing, it can be so many different things. You know, or they're perched on the top of an arbor. Well, they can have so many different imaginary adventures there.
Which is also a critical part of childhood development.
Yes.
Those imaginary adventures.
Yes, that is true.
We need to provide the space and get out of the way.
Yeah, yeah. And they really, all of the research points to the idea that a natural setting is the space. It is the kind of place where kids really will have the best developmental experiences and will be fully stimulated and able to develop in all these different ways that they need to.
And it's also important because it's not a structured activity. So many kids are now, we know, over-structured.
Yeah.
And this is something where they learn to entertain themselves.
Yeah, that unstructured time is really crucial. And the play materials that don't have a specific purpose, those are really important too. Like one of the things that I learned when I was doing the research for this book is that all those plants that we think of as messy, that have all those little pods and seeds and heads and things that fall on the ground and are loose, those loose materials make the best toys because they can be used in a variety of ways. They just prompt you to be creative. And I can remember that with the catalpa tree that my grandma had in her yard. All those flowers would fall, and they could be so many different things, and then the pods would fall, and they could be... We just loved playing with all of that stuff.
But it has to be there.
Yeah, you can't just rake it up and, you know, toss it out. You have to deliberately allow your garden to be a little messier, and that's useful for children and wildlife too, really.
Yes, yeah, all living things. Okay, let's take a minute at least to talk about rain gardens, these places that can collect, spread out water so and allow it to soak into the earth instead of running off into either streams or streets, for instance. And these are, where would somebody want a rain garden? And by where at the moment, I mean, where in the country would somebody?
Anywhere. Yeah, you don't just need a rain garden where there's a lot of rain. Because sometimes what happens...
That does seem what's the obvious answer.
Well, you need... but then, you know, if you live in an arid climate, then when it does rain, boy, it can quickly turn into just rivulets of water if you've seen the water in the...
Or more.
Gullies, you know, yeah, yeah. And so a rain garden doesn't have to be always full of water. Indeed, it's just a way of shaping the earth so that when water does come, the water soaks into the ground rather than contributing to more runoff, which leads to flooding and pooling and all kinds of problems downstream.
And you've got a couple of marvelous photographs, for instance, of places where somebody has designed a waterway so that the runoff from their house goes to a rain garden.
Yeah, and I would say that's really a great way to start. In fact, in my talks, I've started advocating looking at all your drain spouts and letting yourself think about that as you're designing your garden space. Think about, where's the runoff going to go from every one of these drain spouts? Make sure it goes to a garden. You know, set it up so that that's what happens. Or if you are going to design a patio, set it up so that the patio is sloped a little bit and sends the runoff directly to a garden that's adjacent to it. You know, easy ways to make sure that if you're creating runoff by putting in an impervious surface or by having drain spouts come off your roof, that you're putting in a place where the water can go and can soak into the ground and can actually be used to water the plants. You kind of turn it into a resource instead of a waste product.
Yeah, I've realized I'm going to have to rethink my rethinking. We were gonna restore all of the gutters and put in rain barrels, and I suddenly thought, oh, but they shouldn't be going to that end at all. I should have something here so that it can go over there. Thanks, Evelyn.
Yeah, my pleasure. I just did that a few years ago with mine. I set it up so that I redid my rain gutters and I changed where some of them were so that they could each go to a garden. But, you know, yeah. It's great because if you're like me and you just don't want to spend a lot of time taking care of plants, you want them to be more self-sustaining, it makes a great low-care garden.
So you're using the rainwater, which is better for your plants. Rainwater is, of course, better for your plants than tap water because it's not going to have things like chlorine in it.
And it's cheaper for you.
It's cheaper. It also means that you're conserving tap water, which is increasingly a valuable resource across the nation.
That's right. Yeah. And you're diverting something that was a problem and turning it into a plus.
Yep, and you are replenishing the groundwater table, which has been dropping radically across the nation.
So, again, it's win for everybody.
Yeah, with a long list of everybody's.
It just requires, design. Yeah, it's everybody. And it just requires that you design it, you set it up that way at the beginning, and you think through these things at the beginning, and then you can do that.
Yeah, I'm going to have to figure out how I can get these drains to slope in the right direction because I'm not sure that they'll go the same direction as the house roof does. But that's another issue.
Well, good luck with that.
Thank you. I'll take pictures, and if I run into trouble, you'll be hearing from me.
I'd love to hear about it.
That would be fun, actually. Well, we are out of time, and there is so much more to be said, that we were planning to say, and so much more in the book than we have covered here. But this does give, I think, a good sense of the breadth of what you cover and of the many, many possibilities that are available.
Yeah, there really are, and all of them are just unique and interesting in their own ways.
Yeah, you've got pictures from the Southwest and ideas about, using stones or using landscape more than plants in areas where plants aren't going to be crowding up next to each other. And also at how to use screening if you live close to a road. Oh, just lots and lots of stuff.
Well, I'm glad I got you excited and inspired.
Indeed. Thank you. All right. Well, I'll be working on chipping away at my minimal lawn, see if I can get it down to zero.
Excellent. I love to hear that. Yeah. I think the places without lawn are so interesting because every single one of them is different. You know, all lawns are pretty much one is like the other, but every no-mow yard is different.
Now you're quoting great literature. That's the way Tolstoy's War and Peace begins, I believe. But talk about families, not lawns. Anyway.
Well, that's a good way to end, isn't it?
I would say so. Indeed. Let's go for the peace part.
I agree with you.
Thanks so much, Evelyn.
Thank you, Kate. It was my pleasure.
All right. And we'll talk again.
I'd love that.
That was Evelyn Haddon, author of Beautiful No-Mow Yards, 50 Amazing Lawn Alternatives. I realize that I have thrown the literati amongst you into a discomfort that borders upon agony, for of course it was not Tolstoy's War and Peace which began with a comparison between happy and unhappy families. It was Anna Karenina. My profound apologies. That's our show for this week. Be well and garden on.
stones. Man is made of dreams and bones. Feel the need to grow my own, 'cause the time is close at hand. And grain for grain, the sun and rain, find my way in nature's chain, and tune my body and my brain to the music from the land.